Good morning, and welcome to a special edition of the Old Mo Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer. The Old Mole is normally heard on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock. We're very happy to be with you today, joining KBOO's day-long theme, The Sounds of Democracy, as we kick off our station's fall membership drive. Our program this morning has a cultural orientation, film and storytelling, music, art, language, and photography, all as manifestations of democratic struggle. Radio, too, can be a democratic form of struggle, and it is exactly that here on KBOO. We couldn't do it without your support. Later in our program, you'll hear an interview with activist photographer extraordinaire Betty Lee. As a premium for KBOO donors, the Old Mole is offering prints of Betty's photography. 10 lucky donors will be drawn from a hat. I'm old-fashioned that way, so it might not really be a hat, but some random electronic process. But there'll be 10 winners, with every donor eligible. Please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321 or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You can become a monthly sustaining member, up your monthly donation by a few dollars, or make a one-time gift. All are much appreciated. Again, that's what keeps us on the air. So our thanks for whatever you're able to give. Our music on today's program is by Native American singer and songwriter Buffy St. Marie. You'll hear about a film in progress, Jan Hawkins' Necessity Part 2, Rails, Rivers, and the Thin Green Line, co-produced by Kathy Sampson Cruz. Old Mole Jan Hawkins will interview Chief Don Sampson of the Walla Walla peoples, talking about the Native tradition of storytelling and its use in responding to the climate crisis. This is a piece originally produced by Lily Sheoships for KCUW Radio, Umatilla Reservation Community Radio. When our program is posted later today on the Old Mole webpage, you'll be able to see some of the film's artwork by Asa Wright of the Klamath Tribes. After Jan's interview, I'll return with an episode in our continuing series, Another World is Possible, this time reflecting on life, language, and organizing among an indigenous group I worked with in southern Mexico. Can you imagine a world in which everything, from other people to all facets of nature, is thought of as an equal participant in every interchange, and never simply an object to be acted on? There are peoples and cultures that think and live this way, their languages reinforcing a more democratic and earth-friendly vision and way of life. Finally, if you've been to any protest during the past 3 decades, you've probably seen Betty Lee, the short, slight woman behind the camera, always in the thick of things, documenting the resistance that Portland is famous for. Patricia Kohlberg interviews Betty about her decades of photographic work and its significance for Portland's activist community. This is a repeat of an interview we aired originally in early August. I hope it encourages you to go to the webpage we've created for Betty's photography and enter to win your choice of her prints. That page is kboo.fm/Betty Lee. Betty Lee is one word. Betty is spelled B-E-T-T-E. I hope, too, you'll join us on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock for our regular Old Mole programming. The Old Mole focus is on struggle, both celebrating the myriad ways people push for alternatives and analyzing their effectiveness. Every one of us ordinary humans possesses great talents and capacities. Let's, together, build a society in which all of us can flourish. Now, here's Jan Hawkins with Chief Don Sampson.
The Monster Who Came Up the River. This huge monster came up from the ocean. He would open his huge mouth and inhale anything that was in his path. He soon had all the salmon and other fish like sturgeon and eels, all eaten, and because he was so huge, he began taking in the deer and all food animals of the forest. Soon there was nothing left for the people, and they were getting hungry, and babies and old people began to die. Finally, someone went to Coyote and told him he would have to kill the monster. He got a length of a vine that is called Coyote's rope. He tied one end around his waist and coiled the other around his arm. He got some pitchy kindling and flints for starting a fire. He stood on a far hill and called the monster a shameful name. He teased him until the monster began trying to eat him. Every time the mouth opened, Coyote would throw out some useful thing. The monster was near collapsing. The fire got so hot that the monster died and went back into the sea. Some parts of him clung to the sides of the riverbank, so it was rough like it was before Bonneville Dam was built.
That was Don Sampson, Pio Pio Mox Mox, chief of the Walla Walla tribe, narrating The Monster Who Came Up the River, written by beloved Umatilla storyteller Esther Motanik. Don Sampson is director of the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians Climate Change Project and has been a leader for decades in tribal government and non-tribal agencies. My name is Jan Hawken, and I'm a documentary filmmaker from Portland and a programmer at KBOO Community Radio. Well, it's an honor to be with you today on KCUW, Don, to talk about this fable written by Esther Motanik and to discuss the place of Native storytelling in the climate justice movement.
Thanks, Janice. Great to be here with you today.
Well, let's start by talking about Esther Motanik, who wrote this story. Can you tell us some about her?
Yeah, actually, Esther was quite well known here. She was quite a soprano singer. She was, of course, went to college and was one of the first young women, Native women, that became one of the queen of the Pendleton Roundup. Her father was a well-known leader and businessman here. Parson Motanik. He was a member of Cayuse tribe, and he was the second Native American on the Umatilla Indian Reservation to purchase an automobile.
That was quite something. What decades are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, this is back in 1915 when he had his first automobile. There's a famous picture of him. You know, he was he's posed in a traditional headdress. He was a farmer, rancher, had horses and cattle. His children here, of course, which included Esther, and she was one of the first Native American women to be named to the Queen of the Pendleton Roundup. His son Art, Esther's brother, was active in the Roundup for 7 years and was also a well-known singer during the Happy Canyon Pageant. He was there, Don was there at my father's chief ceremony and sang. And so very talented, educated family here on the Umatilla Indian Reservation, but also carried on a lot of the traditional knowledge, including the storytelling, the legends, the history of our tribe. And she and my grandmother grew up together, Carrie Sampson, and my father, Carl Sampson, the late Carl Sampson, who was the former chief, also named Pio Pio Mox Mox. And so very close connection to our family. Her son, one of the sons, Don Motanik, the grandchildren, he's a forester and works on many issues across the U.S. with tribes on forest management. So very respected family. And, you know, Esther was one of those very energetic but also very powerful, progressive woman in her age.
Women have also been storytellers in many Native cultures. Can you say a little about that?
Yeah, that's what I learned. That's what I grew up as we were younger. My grandmother was a great storyteller as well. And oftentimes in the late fall and winter season is when the storytelling would occur. And it was a way of teaching the morals and the values of our people, but also the history and the connection to the land and the animals, the fish, the air, the earth. And so these really demonstrated to us the importance of our relationship and reciprocity with the land, understanding that the animals and fish were relatives, as was the earth, our mother. And so that was part of the teaching. And many of them had values and lessons to be learned. Of course, Coyote, in this story, Spiliai, was a teacher. He was also a trickster. And he was often had great courage and was fearless and did a lot of things to help the people. But at the same time, he was also sly and tricking people into oftentimes doing something they didn't expect to do.
I'd like to talk with you more about the Coyote character in Native storytelling, but also say a bit for our listeners about why this story was chosen to be included in the film I'm working on with a team here in Oregon, including Kathy Sampson Cruza. The film is titled Necessity, Rail Rivers and the Thin Green Line, and it includes a series of animated paintings by Asa Wright, an artist and enrolled member of the Klamath tribes, that will accompany your narration in this story. In addition to this being a local fable that grounds the film in regional indigenous storytelling, can you say something about what the monster and some of the other images in the story mean to you?
Yeah, you think about what's happening now. These are really demonstrate that our knowledge, indigenous knowledge, is ancient, thousands and thousands of generations, not just thousands of years, and that these knowledges were passed down from one generation to the next, oftentimes through stories, but also through these teachings. And these stories were brought out in the wintertime because that was a time where the people were still and were surviving through the winter. They had gathered their foods all spring, summer, and fall and prepared them. And so this was the time for the teaching. And this is where the elders, not just the parents, but the grandparents, the aunts and uncles, were teachers amongst the people. And these were stories about the morals of our people, indigenous connection to the land. And so this story really talks about this animal, this monster who was greedy and came back up the river and began to eat everything. And the long story has a lot of different aspects about how the animals were made from the body of this monster and that were eaten. They came out and were thrown to different parts of the land, and that's where they came from. There's a story about as the monster was dying, one of the last ones to come out the anus of the monster was the stink bug. We call him Titi. And that was why he is the way he is, because he came out the opposite end. And so many of these stories are related and talk about the connection of the creation of the land, creation of the animal people. And they go to the beginning of time when the Netitite, our human beings, were coming to this earth, coming to this land. And how the animal people all stood forward and were called upon. The man in particular came forward to be the salmon, the nusach. And the responsibility of salmon was to go to the great body of water, the ocean, and gather food up and bring that body, his body back, so that the Netitite, the human beings, would have food to eat. The nusach, that was his responsibility. And his sacred name is Waikanish. And when we have those ceremonies every year, we honor Waikanish for following the law, what we call Tamanwit, the law that the Creator gave us to live by. And in return, our Netitite, our Indian people, are supposed to take care of those animals, Take care of the river, which is the blood of our earth, Mother. Take care of all the things that the Creator bestowed for us, gifted us at the beginning of time. And these are part of our ceremonies that we practice, our spiritual and religious beliefs. They are sacred and holy. And so we continue to remind ourselves through song and through these stories, these legends, these prophecies about our obligation and our connection to the land, our relationships. Same way goes on with the roots and the berries and all of the foods that were given Indian names. We honor and respect them today. So that's a little bit of history about our people and the relationship to these stories and our relationship to the earth. And we're seeing things that are happening now that we had heard about in prophecies, and we're seeing these impacts on the land because the non-Indian people have basically abused the land and forgot what their role and responsibility is as equals, and having a reciprocal obligation to protect things as those also provide for us as well as the human beings.
So the monster in this story has different dimensions to it, and that we are all taking from and depend on the creatures in the world around us, which is a different relationship to nature than colonial settler culture, which views the natural world as a resource to be tamed, controlled, or extracted from. So in this story, the monster is, in a sense, part of nature itself, but there is a warning that things are out of balance, of an exploitive relationship to nature, and Coyote embodies resistance to that, resistance to the monster that takes over, that devours. So the story could be read as a metaphor for colonialism. Would you agree with that kind of interpretation?
Absolutely, and I think it's the human nature that we as human beings oftentimes have the ability to think in a different way. And you'll see this all over the world, but particularly here in America, when the immigrants came here, they began to exploit the land, and their perspective was that they owned things, that they had a right to take things and use them for their own rich and greed and power. And I think that's really what Coyote was always telling us, is that you have to be humble, and this is the way that our people were raised. You have to share. You have to be respectful. You have to know what reciprocity is, which means you take only what you need and you give back. And that's the importance of this way of life that we had. And I think that is really what's happening, is that this story kind of illustrates that things will change. The people, the salmon will be gone. The food will disappear. And we're seeing that happen right today because of the industrialization of our country, our native country here. It was a beautiful, productive country 400, 500 years ago, and it's been exploited much like Europe was in the 1200, 1500s. And now we're seeing the impacts, whether it be dams on the river, polluted waters, we're seeing air pollution, we're seeing climate change, which is increasing these catastrophic wildfires. The fossil fuel industry and industrialization has transformed this earth. And now this earth is much stronger than we think and is more powerful than we could imagine. We're insignificant. And there was a time where we lived in balance. And that's what we're trying to do now, is refine that balance and that respect. And so indigenous knowledge and these stories and the wisdom that we bring from these generations is very useful today, not only just for our indigenous people, but for all people around the world, and that they have to learn to live in balance with the earth, respect things. And I think that's really part of what the story tells, and many other stories. We have prophecies that projected that we'd be seeing these things now, and indeed that's what's happening. And so as indigenous people, we have to be strong. We have to go back to our indigenous values and our lifestyle.
In closing, can you say a little more about how you would weave together the themes of tragic loss and trauma on the one hand, as part of Indigenous history that's so important to be told and remembered, as well as the stories of creative resistance and resilience. For many of us on the documentary team, Coyote represented that creative and clever side of fighting an enemy that is in many ways more powerful than you. So how do you think about those two sides of storytelling and a path forward for all of us?
Well, you know, that's, as I mentioned, Coyote was a teacher, and the creator, Namipia, sent him to teach us. And there were times when we were going the wrong way, or we fought within each other or against each other or did something wrong, he came back to teach us the right way of life. How to live. And so today, as Indigenous people, we are banding together across the United States, across countries around the globe. And the knowledge and the experience and the truth that we bring about how we live in harmony with the earth is really what's guiding people now. They're starting to listen finally after all these years when we were exploited and the genocide that occurred, our lands taken, our culture, our language taken, boarding schools, all of that is now coming full circle, and our people are beginning to strengthen, renewing our language, renewing our connection, renewing our spirituality. We think that will be what leads the world into a better future.
And a path forward for all of us.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. We have a new generation of people, young people coming up. You know, you think of the Greta Thunberg as one example of people saying, look, we can't just think of ourselves and short-term gain over the long-term future of our children like us. And they're speaking up, and they find that connection with Indigenous people because we care about the seven generations that follow. You know, we only borrow this land from our children, and we're obligated and duty-bound to give it to them better than it was. And so that is really our responsibility. So that is something that I think is true amongst many tribes and Indigenous people around the world.
Well, Don Sampson, I hope we can have more conversations about Native storytelling and climate justice. We've been recognizing this story by Esther Motonic, but as you say, there are many stories to tell, and they play in all cultures a vital role and have an important place and in inspiring people during a time that can seem bleak and hopeless, but also as we try to find a way forward through this climate catastrophe we're in.
Yep, we have to be Coyote. We have to be creative. We have to think right. Sometimes I get called Coyote, but I think you're a Coyote too, Janice.
Yes, I'm honored. I'm so honored to be a Coyote with you. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Don Sampson, chief of the Walla Walla tribe, about the story, The Monster Who Came Up the River, that will also be included in the film, Necessity, Rail Rivers and the Thin Green Line.
Sisters have died. of our forefathers sings. The will to live will be done. We will no longer be pawns. To greed and to war, we will be idle no more. And we must stand for the right to be free. And we will rebuild a just society.
Jan Hocken and Chief Don Sampson created that piece for the Umatilla Reservation Community Radio. The song by Buffy St. Marie is Sing Our Own Song. I've had the pleasure of watching the first Necessity film and look forward to this next one. You're listening to a special edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. Now it's time for another episode in our continuing series, Another World is Possible. This is Norm Diamond. A listener sent me a cartoon. It's a hand holding a pen, drawing another hand also holding a pen, which in turn is drawing the first hand. You can see it on our webpage once today's program is posted. The cartoon is an apt metaphor for how language and thought interact and shape each other. Our premises about the way the world works, our underlying worldview, is embodied in our language. Our language, in turn, shapes the possibilities we're able to imagine in the world. All European-derived languages, for instance, create a sharp distinction between subject and object, actor and acted upon. But there are languages that don't recognize that distinction, that don't permit the speaker even to conceive of other people, or of nature for that matter, as mere recipients of action. Those languages themselves both reflect and reinforce the belief that we are all equal participants in the world and in every interaction. This is hard to understand because our language and way of thinking limits us, but it has real consequences for the way we and others live. Today, on Another World is Possible, I want to try to take you inside the culture of a people who see the world differently. You've probably heard of the Zapatistas, the EZLN, the group in southern Mexico that rose up on January 1, 1994, when NAFTA, the so-called Free Trade Agreement, was to come into effect. Among other consequences, NAFTA forced the breakup of communal land ownership in Mexico and undercut Mexican agriculture by opening that country wide to the import of GMO corn from the U.S. You may remember spokespersons wearing ski masks and calling themselves subcomandantes because there was to be no comandante above the rest. Or you may have been struck by how the leadership included a large percentage of women. The Zapatistas have held many international gatherings to explain and promote their vision for how society should function. They continue to govern five autonomous regions in the state of Chiapas. One of their core constituent groups is the Toxolabales. Before telling you about the language of the Toxolabales, I'd like to tell you just a bit about them and the organizing I was privileged to be part of that led up to the Zapatistas. The Toxolabales are a Mayan group, long ago driven deep into the mountains by the Spanish conquerors. To get their produce to the market in the mid-20th century, they had to haul it for hours down steep paths, then hope to catch a bus into town. Bus companies and drivers treated them badly. To them, these were indios, a slur word in Mexican Spanish. More than once, I saw drivers deliberately swerve onto the shoulders of the road to scatter waiting Toxolabal women and ruin their produce, then drive on without stopping. Hard as it is to believe, this was a people without songs. I'm not sure I understood this. They knew what songs are, but told me that Spaniards had forbidden them. an early step in our organizing was to create songs together, simple songs, just describing the work of preparing food or in the fields, songs that brought joy, certainly to me in hearing them echo off the mountains as people worked, and brought people together. Getting their own transport to avoid the racist commercial buses was another step forward in a complex undertaking. The Tocholabales live in small, scattered villages. Coordinating the resources and coordinating the schedule required bringing the entire community together. That meant creating a decision-making structure that for the first time linked the scattered villages. What developed was a form of representative democracy. All the adults in each village met to discuss whatever the issue was, then picked a representative to take their decisions to a higher-level gathering that would make the final decision. Within the villages that I saw, men sat in a circle and did much of the talking. Women sat in a circle around them and generally, quietly, prompted the men. The representative, generally a man, was chosen for that particular issue, not as a standing official. One result was getting their own, wildly decorated, community-wide bus. That early organizing in the 1970s and 80s, with encouragement from the liberation theology bishopric of Chiapas, is what enabled the joining together of a number of different communities, Tocholabales among them, that became the Zapatista movement. Before turning back to the language of the Tocholabales, here's some more of our featured artist, Buffy St. Marie.
Ooh, you better wake up. Man, it's like you're dead and gone. See you moving around the same old neighborhood. Same old thoughts in your head spin around and around, round. Oh, I know that you're a city boy. But if you got a chance to go,
that was Buffy St. Marie with an excerpt from Chocho Fire. And you're listening to a special edition of the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is a special edition because we in the Old Mole are happy to be part of kicking off KBOO's fall membership drive. It's overwhelmingly because of listener contributions that KBOO is able to stay on the air. Please go to KBOOFM/give or text the letters KBOO to 44-321 or send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. In turning to Tocholabal, the language, I'd like to start with a story. Language, of course, is partly based on experience. If a people hasn't encountered a particular experience, they may not have a vocabulary or even concepts that cover that experience. A good example would be the language in the treaties the U.S. government forced Native American tribes to sign, giving up their lands. If you've ever looked at any of these treaties, they're full of concepts like reserved rights that have no meaning in the native languages. People could not have understood what they were signing, however voluntary their signature seemed. When there are new experiences, something else happens with language. If there's no vocabulary to describe the experience, words can be adopted from another culture. That does not mean, however, that they have the same exact meaning from culture to culture. And here's the story. The Spanish word abogado means lawyer, referring to the same profession in Spanish as in English. For the Mayan groups in southern Mexico, however, abogado refers to their specific experience. For them, the word means someone who comes from the outside trying to trick you into doing something against your interest. The Wycliffe Bible Translators are a missionary group that specializes in translating the Christian Bible into languages that have not yet taken written form. My path crossed with theirs near the Guatemalan border. They come into communities, learn the languages, translate and proselytize. They also make those languages and the intelligence they gather about those communities available to the U.S. government. They represent cultural imperialism in many guises, including being oblivious to the resonance of vocabulary that crosses cultural boundaries. When they translated the biblical "Jesus is our advocate" from the book of John, using the word "avogado," the community came to its own conclusions about what brand of religion these missionaries were pushing, and threw them out. Before you grin and think that served these missionaries right, I want to point out that in the Toholoba language, it is impossible to say something like, "we threw them out." The action of ousting the Wycliffe Bible translators is understood differently. The grammatical structure of Toholoba does not recognize a world divided into subjects and objects, acted and acted upon. Indo-European languages have built-in divisions and implicit hierarchies. Toholoba does not. Their world is interactive, non-hierarchical, democratic, and participatory. The Toholoba version, the way their language channels their understanding, would be something like, "we and the Wycliffe Bible translators created an experience in which they departed. I'm telling you this." But you cannot say it that way in Toholoba. The best way I can come up with to translate that phrase, "I'm telling you this," would be something like, "I'm speaking, you're hearing." "I love you," in Toholoba, would be something like, "you're creating an experience in which I love." It's nearly impossible to translate satisfactorily when the underlying worldview is so different. For the Toholobales, we and the world around us are all equal and all interrelated, not just human beings, but nature as well. This way of looking at the world extends to their way of being in the world. One hand holding a pen, drawing another hand also holding a pen, which in turn is drawing the first hand. Language and thought interacting and shaping each other. How do we know another, better world is possible? One way is by realizing that what we take for granted, what is built into the very structure of our language and way of thinking, is not simply obvious and common sense. There are peoples that find our premises wrong-headed and repellent. Our Western languages can express many wonderful things. They also may be holding us back. It's not only a new vocabulary that we require for the possibilities we see, but a new common sense, a new set of premises to expand those possibilities. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're calling the next part of the program 30 Years in the Streets. That's how long Betty Lee has been participating in demonstrations with her camera. Here she is talking with Old Mole Patricia Kohlberg.
Those of us on the left who live in resistance to a repressive and capitalist-controlled social order don't even have control over how our own movements are depicted in the corporate media. And all too often, stories are told about us or images are made of us that don't reflect our point of view. And it's just one more way that our voices are suppressed or distorted, or one more way that our history ends up being told by others and often in the service of their own interests. But in Portland, we've been lucky enough to have political activist and photographer Betty Lee as one of our own documentarians. Betty has been capturing images of street actions and protests here locally for 3 decades. If you've ever been to a demonstration in Portland since around 1990, you might have seen her, the short, slight woman behind the camera who is always in the thick of things. And today I'm here with Betty to talk about her camera activism, what she's tried to capture with her images, and how her images have contributed to the local communities in resistance. For the next several months, the Moles are going to post one of Betty's photos every week on the KBOO website, but also on the Old Mole Facebook page, and we'll include reflections from Betty on her photos, and then we'll end up with an online photographic retrospective of 30 years in the streets of Portland through the lens of Betty Lee's camera. So welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Betty.
Thank you, Patsy, for such a wonderful introduction of my work. And I'm very happy to be on the Old Mole Variety Hour because Old Mole has been one of my favorite, if not my most favorite, KBOO program.
Oh, thank you for that endorsement. So Betty, you moved to Portland around 1990 and you've been snapping photos of street protests in Portland ever since then. You captured the protest against the murder of Mulugeta Sirah by neo-Nazi skinheads, images of Occupy PDX, the various protests against the first Gulf War and the Shell No, that wonderful and successful blockade of Shell Oil's icebreaker several years back. You captured images of the May Day police riot back in 2000, police riot against peaceful demonstrators. And most recently, you were taking photos of the more than 100 days of Black Lives Matter protests. Also, over the years, you've been a photographer for Portland Indie Media, the Portland Alliance. You've covered various events at the requests of activist organizations. But most of your work, I believe, has been just you showing up. And most of your focus has been on instances of civil disobedience or direct action or strikes and demonstrations. Tell us why you were particularly drawn to photographing those events, those kinds of events.
Wow, that's a pretty detailed history, what I've been doing for the last 30 years. Photography is a visual medium, so it's so much more interesting photographing people in action out in the streets than people sitting around and talking in a meeting in a controlled environment. There's just so much going on out in the streets during protests. It's like an ongoing drama, you know, like people bring their homemade protest signs, they wear t-shirts with funny messages on them. There are giant puppets, there's theater, there's singing, there's dancing. And so for me, it's just a visual feast. I also think that photography can offer us a visceral experience. There's just an incredible amount of energy and excitement and intensity when hundreds or even thousands of people gather out in the streets in protest.
Tell us what you were trying to capture in your images of people in the streets marching and demonstrating. What, for example, would set your images apart from the images that the corporate media would take?
I think that my approach to photography is very different from the corporate photojournalist because I'm personally involved in the struggle for justice. For me, it's a calling and a commitment. It's not a career. I'm not a professional photojournalist. I don't get paid for what I do. And I'm not going to win any Pulitzer Prizes. You know?
Oh, you never know.
So I think what I bring in, which is in, reflected in my images, is a much deeper level of awareness and appreciation of the social and political issues that motivate us to go out into the streets. Also, I don't pretend to be objective. I chose to be on the side of the people over 30 years ago, and I'm not going to change.
I want to talk a little bit about what you think makes a compelling image. And to do that, what I would love for you to do is to describe for us that one image that you took of, they were actually two pro-war demonstrators for the Gulf War, I believe, who were carrying the flags and had their two kids. Could you describe that photo to us and then why you took it the way that you did? It's a very interesting photo.
In answer to your first question, what makes a compelling image? I think a compelling image, it has to carry a visual impact. It has to give you a visceral experience that makes you feel. It has to have emotional intensity. And if the image makes you think and inspires you to take action, then I would say that's a great image. As for your second question about the image that I took at a pro-war rally during the Gulf War in 1991. Ironically, it turned out to be an anti-war image, even though I took it at a pro-war rally. And what it shows are two men carrying two huge American flags that have completely covered their faces. There are also two young boys who are presumably their sons, who are probably really bored and they're just goofing off, and they've stuck their heads between their father's knees. So I think that this image is successful because it works on many levels. Aesthetically, you know, whenever you see images of American flags, and in this image, they're huge. So they're the main element in the image. American flags have an iconic power, which can evoke so many different emotions. And also aesthetically, you know, that's the juxtaposition between the headless fathers and the headless sons. And symbolically, it shows that nationalism is like a religion in America. It's such a powerful ideology that it obliterates critical and independent thinking. And it's often passed down from fathers to sons. And it compels mostly men to march off to war, to obey orders without question, and to fight and die in endless wars that many of them don't know much about. So for me, I thought that that image really captured a lot of these sort of meaningful issues about patriarchy, about nationalism, and about the use of nationalism to justify endless wars.
Well, it's a very striking image, and I believe it's also obvious in the image that the men are white.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe I should say white nationalism.
Well, there we go. What are the particular challenges that you faced trying to take photos during a direct action or a demonstration?
Well, street protests are incredibly unpredictable and things can change very quickly. So I gotta react very quickly and take the photograph in a split second, otherwise I'll miss it. And obviously I cannot photograph everything and I cannot be everywhere. So I do miss a lot of shots. I think a lot of times it just comes down to luck, you know, being at the right place at the right time.
I was just going to say, I think you also sought out where the most intensity was in those demonstrations. You weren't shy.
Well, that was back in the day before I got much older. But you're right. I mean, back in the day, I would often go to the front lines because that's where the action is. But now it's just too risky for me.
Talk a little bit more about how your experience as a street photographer during demonstration has changed over time.
Well, like I mentioned, I'm much older, so I cannot outrun the cops anymore. If I do go to the front lines, I try to be there for as short a time as possible.
Has the nature of the demonstrations changed over time?
Oh, most definitely. I think that dissent and our protests have become increasingly criminalized at the same time that the police have become more and more militarized. And it's really frightening for me to be out at the protests, especially during the Black Lives Matter protests last year, because the police just pounded us, you know, with tear gas and pepper spray and stun grenades and rubber bullets and impact munitions. Many people were seriously injured. And I don't think we should accept that as the new normal, you know, because what it really means is that the state and the police are undermining our First Amendment rights to go out there and protest through intimidation and through, you know, increased risk of injury and arrest. And also, I think it's a backlash against the success of the Black Lives Matter movement last year.
I want to ask you one last question about your photography. I've heard you describe it as doing cultural work. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk a little bit about what that means and why it's important?
Well, I think that the common theme that runs through my work is the power of the people to create real social change. So we are the ones who are making history and creating change. So it's really crucial for us to tell our own stories from our point of view. We really can't rely on the corporate media. They're motivated by their own agenda or the corporate and official narratives. So we really need to control the narrative and be able to articulate what's in our hearts and minds and what we're fighting for and why. And I think that telling our own stories through culture that includes, you know, photography, the visual arts, writings, music, dance, theater, the independent media, all of that is so important. And I really hope that my images are a small contribution.
Oh, I think they have been. And again, as I look through the images, as I've been doing over the past couple of weeks, it's striking to me the continuities over time. Some of the issues that we were fighting against or fighting for 3 decades ago are still with us now.
Yes.
That a lot of the issues that the demonstrations and the way you photograph them demonstrate the connections between a lot of those issues, that racist murders have a lot to do with wars in Iraq, have a lot to do with Shell oil destroying the environment, that these are all related issues. I think that comes through. And I think they're very inspiring. They help us reflect back on, as a movement, where we've been and kind of take stock of things. And I just would like to say to you, Betty, on behalf of the activist community, I want to thank you for your incredibly generous contribution to documenting our history. We're going to be posting a photo with Betty's reflections on that particular photo every week on our KBOO and Facebook pages. And our listeners can go to the Old Mole Facebook page to view what'll be a growing collection of Betty's photos. You can contact Betty directly at leebetty, that's L-E-E-B-E-T-T-E, at gmail.com. Betty, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Patsy, for your support.
Thanks to Old Moles, Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hawken, for their contributions today. To their guests, Chief Don Sampson and Betty Lee, and to Old Mole Denise Morris for editing Jan's piece. Thanks, too, to the staff at KBOO for their guidance and responsiveness in difficult circumstances. 80% of the funds the station relies on come from listeners like you. But not all listeners donate or are even in a position to donate. If you're able, please support this important community resource. Go to kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44-321, or send a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And remember that 10 donors, at whatever level you can, will receive your choice of a Betty Lee print on behalf of Betty and the Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll go out with more music from Buffy St. Marie. Nono Keshegesh. Catch you next Monday morning at 9.
I never saw so many.